Chapter 7. The question. That's all I have to say, sir. I should have liked to contradict my opinionated servant at that moment. But, excellent as the story was in itself, I felt that he had hit on the weak point, so far as Jarber's particular purpose in reading it was concerned. And that is what you have to say, is it? Repeated Jarber. I enter this room announcing that I have a series of discoveries, and you jump instantly to the conclusion that the first of the series exhausts my resources. Have I your permission, dear lady, to enlighten this obtuse person, if possible, by reading number 2? My work is behindhand, ma'am, said Trottle, moving to the door, the moment I gave Jarber leave to go on. Stop where you are, I said, in my most peremptory manner, and give Mr. Jarber his fair opportunity of answering your objection now you have made it. Trottle sat down with the look of a martyr, and Jarber began to read with his back turned on the enemy more decidedly than ever. Going into society, at one period of its reverses, the house fell into the occupation of a showman. He was found registered as its occupier, on the parish books of the time, when he rented the house, and there was therefore no need of any clue to his name. But, he himself was less easy to be found. For, he had led a wandering life, and settled people had lost sight of him, and people who plumed themselves on being respectable were shy of admitting that they had ever known anything of him. At last, among the marshlands near the river's level, that lie about Deptford and the neighboring market gardens, a grizzled personage in velveteen, with a face so cut up by varieties of weather that he looked as if he had been tattooed, was found smoking a pipe at the door of a wooden house on wheels. The wooden house was laid up in ordinary for the winter, near the mouth of a muddy creek, and everything near it, the foggy river, the misty marshes, and the steaming market gardens, smoked in company with the grizzled man. In the midst of this smoking party, the funnel chimney of the wooden house on wheels was not remiss, but took its pipe with the rest in a companionable manner. On being asked if it were he who had once rented the house to let, Grizzled Velveteen looked surprised, and said yes. Then his name was Maxman? That was it, Toby Maxman, which lawfully christened Robert, but called in the line, from a infant, Toby. There was nothing a gin Toby Maxman, he believed? If there was suspicion of such, mention it. There was no suspicion of such, he might rest assured. But, some inquiries were making about that house, and would he object to say why he left it? Not at all, why should he? He left it, along of a dwarf. Along of a dwarf? Mr. Maxman repeated, deliberately and emphatically, along of a dwarf. Might it be compatible with Mr. Maxman's inclination and convenience to enter, as a favor, into a few particulars? Mr. Maxman entered into the following particulars. It was a long time ago, to begin with, afore lotteries and a deal more was done away with. Mr. Maxman was looking about for a good pitch, and he see that house, and he says to himself, I'll have you, if you're to be had. If money'll get you, I'll have you. The neighbors cut up rough, and made complaints, but Mr. Maxman don't know what they would have had. It was a lovely thing. First of all, there was the canvas, representing the picture of the giant, in Spanish trunks and a ruff, who was himself half the eighth of the house, and was run up with a line, and pulley to a pole on the roof, so that his head was coeval with the parapet. Then, there was the canvas, representing the picture of the Albina lady, showing her white hair to the army and navy in correct uniform. Then, there was the canvas, representing the picture of the wild Indian a scalping a member of some foreign nation. Then, there was the canvas, representing the picture of a child of a British planter, seized by 2 boa constrictors, not that we never had no child, nor no constrictors neither. Similarly, there was the canvas, representing the picture of the wild ass of the prairies, not that we never had no wild asses, nor wouldn't have had 'em at a gift. Last, there was the canvas, representing the picture of the dwarf, and like him too, considering, with George IV in such a state of astonishment at him as his majesty couldn't with his utmost politeness and stoutness express. The front of the house was so covered with canvases that there wasn't a spark of daylight ever visible on that side. Maxman's amusements, 15 foot long by 2 foot high, ran over the front door and parlor winders. The passage was a arbor of green baize and garden stuff. A barrel organ performed there unceasing. And as to respectability, if threepence ain't respectable, what is? But, the dwarf is the principal article at present, and he was worth the money. He was wrote up as Major Tchovsky, of the Imperial Belgradarian Brigade. Nobody couldn't pronounce the name, and it never was intended anybody should. The public always turned it, as a regular rule, into Tchovsky. In the line he was called Chops, partly on that account, and partly because his real name, if he ever had any real name which was very dubious, was Stakes. He was a uncommon small man, he really was. Certainly not so small as he was made out to be, but where is your dwarf as is? He was a most uncommon small man, with a most uncommon large head, and what he had inside that head, nobody ever knowed but himself. Even supposing himself to have ever took stock of it, which it would have been a stiff job for even him to do. The kindest little man as never growed. Spirited, but not proud. When he traveled with the spotted baby, though he knowed himself to be a natural dwarf, and knowed the baby's spots, to be put upon him artificial, he nursed that baby like a mother. You never heard him give a ill name to a giant. He did allow himself to break out into strong language respecting the fat lady from Norfolk, but that was an affair of the art, and when a man's art has been trifled with by a lady, and the preference give to a Indian, he ain't master of his actions. He was always in love, of course. Every human natural phenomenon is. And he was always in love with a large woman. I never knowed the dwarf as could be got to love a small one. Which helps to keep them the curiosities they are. One singular idea he had in that head of his, which must have meant something, or it wouldn't have been there. It was always his opinion that he was entitled to property. He never would put his name to anything. He had been taught to write by the young man without arms, who got his living with his toes, quite a writing master he was, and taught scores in the line, but Chops would have starved to death, afore he'd have gained a bit of bread by putting his hand to a paper. This is the more curious to bear in mind, because he had no property, nor hope of property, except his house and a sarser. When I say his house, I mean the box, painted and got up outside like a reglar six roomer that he used to creep into, with a diamond ring or quite as good to look at, on his forefinger, and ring a little bell out of what the public believed to be the drawing room winder. And when I say a sarser, I mean a chainy sarser in which he made a collection for himself at the end of every entertainment. His cue for that, he took from me. Ladies and gentlemen, the little man will now walk 3 times round the caron, and retire behind the curtain. When he said anything important, in private life, he mostly wounded up with this form of words, and they was generally the last thing he said to me at night afore he went to bed. He had what I consider a fine mind, a poetic mind. His ideas respecting his property never come upon him so strong as when he sat upon a barrel organ, and had the handle turned. Arter the vibration had run through him a little time, he would screech out, "Toby, I feel my property coming grind away. I'm counting my guineas by thousands. Toby, grind away. Toby, I shall be a man of fortune. I feel the mint a jingling in me, Toby, and I'm swelling out into the Bank of England." Such is the influence of music on a poetic mind. Not that he was partial to any other music, but a barrel organ, on the contrary, hated it. He had a kind of a everlasting grudge agin the public, which is a thing you may notice in many phenomenons that get their living out of it. What riled him most in the nature of his occupation was that it kept him out of society. He was continually saying, Toby, my ambition is to go into society. The curse of my position towards the public is that it keeps me out of society. This don't signify to a low beast of a Indian. He ain't formed for society. This don't signify to a spotted baby. He ain't formed for society. I am. Nobody never could make out what Chops done with his money. He had a good salary, down on the drum every Saturday as the day came round, besides having the run of his teeth, and he was a woodpecker to eat, but all dwarfs are. The sarser was a little income, bringing him in so many halfpence that he'd carry him for a week together, tied up in a pocket handkercher. And yet he never had money. And it couldn't be the fat lady from Norfolk, as was once supposed. Because it stands to reason that when you have a animosity towards a Indian, which makes you grind your teeth at him to his face, and which can hardly hold you from goosing him audible, when he's going through his war dance, it stands to reason you wouldn't under them circumstances deprive yourself to support that Indian in the lap of luxury. Most unexpected, the mystery come out one day at Egham races. The public was shy of being pulled in, and Chops was ringing his little bell out of his drawing room winder, and was snarling to me over his shoulder as he kneeled down with his legs out at the back door, for he couldn't be shoved into his house without kneeling down, and the premises wouldn't accommodate his legs, was snarling, here's a precious public for you, why the devil don't they tumble up? When a man in the crowd holds up a carrier pigeon, and cries out, if there's any person here as has got a ticket, the lottery's just drawed, and the number as has come up for the great prize is 3-7-42. 3-7-42. I was given the man to the Furies myself, for calling off the public's attention, for the public will turn away, at any time, to look at anything in preference to the thing showed them. And if you doubt it, get them together for any individual purpose on the face of the earth, and send only two people in late, and see if the whole company ain't far more interested in taking particular notice of them two than of you. I say, I wasn't best pleased with the man for callin' out, and wasn't blessing him in my own mind, when I see Chop's little bell fly out of winder at a old lady, and he gets up and kicks his box over, exposing the whole secret, and he catches hold of the calves of my legs, and he says to me, carry me into the wan, Toby, and throw a pail of water over me or I may. Dead man, for I've come into my property. 12,000-odd hundred pound was Chop's winnings. He had bought a half ticket for the 25,000 prize, and it had come up. The first use he made of his property was to offer to fight the wild Indian for 500 pound a side, him with a poisoned darning needle, and the Indian with a club. But the Indian being in want of backers to that amount, it went no further. Arter he had been mad for a week in a state of mind, in short, in which, if I had let him sit on the organ for only 2 minutes, I believe he would have bust, but we kept the organ from him. Mr. Chops come round, and behaved liberal and beautiful to all. He then sent for a young man he knowed, as had a wery genteel appearance, and was a bonnet at a gaming booth, most respectable brought up, father having been imminent in the livery stable line, but unfortunate in a commercial crisis, through painting a old gray, ginger bay, and selling him with a pedigree. And Mr. Chops said to this bonnet, who said his name was Normandy, which it wasn't, Normandy, I may going into society. Will you go with me? Says Normandy. Do I understand you, Mr. Chops, to intimate that the allay of the expenses of that move will be borne by yourself? Correct, says Mr. Chops. And you shall have a princely allowance too. The bonnet lifted Mr. Chops upon a chair, to shake hands with him, and replied in poetry, with his eyes seemingly full of tears. My boat is on the shore, and my bark is on the sea, and I do not ask for more, but I'll go along with thee. They went into society, in a chay and four greys with silk jackets. They took lodgings in Pall Mall, London, and they blazed away. in consequence of a note that was brought to Bartlemy Fair in the autumn of next year by a servant, most wonderful, got up in milk-white cords and tops. I cleaned myself, and went to Pall Mall. One evening happened it. The gentleman was at their wine arter dinner, and Mr. Chopsize was more fixed in that head of his than I thought good for him. There was three of em in company, I mean, and I knowed the third well. When last met, he had on a white Roman shirt, and a bishop's mitre covered with leopard skin, and played the clarionet all wrong, in a band at a wild beast show. This gent took on not to know me, and Mr. Chops said, "Gentlemen, this is a old friend of former days." And Normandy looked at me through a eyeglass, and said, "Maxman, glad to see you." Which I'll take my oath he wasn't. Mr. Chops, to get him convenient to the table, had his chair on a throne much of the form of George the Fourth's in the canvas, but he hardly appeared to me to be king there in any other point of view, for his two gentlemen ordered about like emperors. They was all dressed like May Day gorgeous. And as to wine, they swam in all sorts. I made the round of the bottles, first separate to say I had done it, and then mixed them all together to say I had done it, and then tried two of them as half and half, and then t'other two. Altogether, I passed a pleasant evening, but with a tendency to feel muddled, until I considered it good manners to get up and say, "Mr. Chops, the best of friends must part. I thank you for the variety of foreign drains you have stood so handsome. I looks towards you in red wine, and I takes my leave." Mr. Chops replied, "If you'll just hitch me out of this over your right arm, Maxman, and carry me downstairs, I'll see you out." I said I couldn't think of such a thing, but he would have it, so I lifted him off his throne. He smelt strong of maidery, and I couldn't help thinking as I carried him down, that it was like carrying a large bottle full of wine, with a rather ugly stopper, a good deal out of proportion. When I set him on the doormat in the hall, he kept me close to him, by holding onto my coat collar, and he whispers, "I ain't happy, Maxman. What's on your mind, Mr. Chops? They don't use me well. They ain't grateful to me. They puts me on the mantelpiece, when I won't have in more champagne wine, and they locks me in the sideboard, when I won't give up my property. Get rid of 'em, Mr. Chops." "I can't. We're in society together, and what would society say?" Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.